Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Professor Raymond Boyle, who's a Professor of Communications at the University of Glasgow, about his new book, The Talent Industry, Television, Cultural Intermediaries, and New Digital Pathways. So welcome to the podcast.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Dave.
This is a great book, and it couldn't be better timed, really. Just this week, we've seen discussions about the relationship between the BBC, Netflix, Amazon. Almost every day there's not just in the kind of media pages, but sometimes, you know, in quite prominent bits of news outlets, there's discussions about how the TV industry works, its relationship to film, how it's going to pay for itself, these kind of new models. And so this book is just perfect for what we need right now to kind of explain it. And I guess the place to start is, where did the idea come from? You know, were you sort of sat 2 years ago thinking, in 2 years' time, we're going to need a book like this? Or, you know, is it just kind of lucky that your agenda has coincided with this moment?
Well, it's very kind of you to say that about the book, Dave. I mean, like a lot of these things, it's probably a mixture of both. I've been interested in the notion of talent and what is meant by that for a number of years, but primarily, originally, I was interested in the field actually of sport and the sports industry. And I'm fortunate enough to have contacts with people working in the professional industry. And I've always been fascinated by the way in which people think about how we identify and capture talent and how we nurture it and develop it. And then what struck me over the last couple of years is the way in which the term talent has kind of moved into the political and public mainstream discourse, much in the same way as creativity has, innovation, these various kind of key trigger words, where we're told that, be it television or the British economy, you know, we need to be investing in new talent. And, you know, the term is obviously ubiquitous on television through things like X Factor and Britain's Got Talent, etc. So it's been around. But I was interested originally in thinking about what is the difference between the sports industry and, say, the television sector. As I began to think about it, I realised that was probably a volume of books, far too big to be covered in one book. And I began to focus more on the television sector. So it was really kind of driven by my own broader interest in the television sector and building on the previous book that I had done with Lisa Kelly, which was looking at business television formats on television for business and representations of entrepreneurship. And it kind of came out slightly of that. And this other nagging thing in the back of my head, where I was always interested in talent, and in the sports sector, it was very, what I was interested in was, you have all these metrics, you have all this data about measuring people and measuring talent and measuring performance, and yet so much of it still comes down to either somebody likes you, somebody doesn't like you, somebody thinks there's something there despite the metrics, or something thinks that there's something there because of the metrics or whatever, and that relationship between the human element and the kind of the attempts to formalize that was the kind of jumping off point for thinking about the book.
What is it then? What is talent? And it's really interesting you mentioned that comparison with sport and data, and we've seen a lot actually both in what we call soccer for American audiences, but also in things like baseball, of, you know, the rise of kind of metrics and statistics. But yeah, obviously in TV, you know, it's a very different sort of beast, really. So what does the word even mean?
Well, this is one of the interesting dimensions to it. The danger of sounding like an academic in that sense is that it's actually a very contested term. I mean, it's one of these terms that everybody uses, but actually people are often using it in very different contexts. In the television industry context, I was interested also in looking at the placing it within a broader historical context. So, again, just one of my own interest is always in looking at, you know, the long story, the bigger picture, the historical, and trying to place these within historical context. So the term talent has often been used in television, the industry and sector over the years. And actually, originally, apparently the original definition of it was to do with talent agent and the fact that talent agents would bring to the attention of producers particular, normally on-screen performers. And then over the years, this becomes shortened to the term talent and referring to the notions of the talent, and traditionally often referring to on-screen talent. But in the book, I'm interested in both on and off-screen, as we talk about. There's a bigger dimension to it, of course, which is the definition of talent in the public or business context has become a big issue probably in the last 20 years, and the McKinsey type reports around the battle for talent is something that's exercised a lot of human resources departments in the industry sector, not necessarily in television. And this notion that there are people out there who have innate or particular skills and abilities which make them distinctive and unique, and that as a business or organization, you need to, as it were, build a team by selecting the appropriate talents to work together. And this kind of notion of, I mean, at its core, a debate around nature and nurture. You know, is talent something that's innate? You know, are musicians born? Can you teach talent? Or is it something which actually can be learned and developed? Was, again, something that was interesting to me. And that's why the first chapter of the book really kind of positions that within the broader literature around talent and what it means and what it shifted. If I were to say at the end of the book what I think it has shifted, I think historically talent has referred to artistic or cultural ability, often on screen. And I think now increasingly talent is actually about your commercial or advertising or subscriber value. So it's kind of shifted away from a purely, not always purely, but certainly heavily weighted towards cultural artistic ability. Can you write? Can you sing? Can you dance? Can you present? What skill sets have you got that make you different? To actually, will this particular piece of talent, you know, drive subscribers? Will they deliver particular audiences to advertisers? Will they speak to particular audiences that we need to speak with? And I think that's been one of the bigger shifts, which you can really only see when you begin to take the long view.
Obviously, this is related to the incredible transformation that the kind of the moment of the digital has brought to television. And it'd be good to kind of cut into that a bit, actually, thinking about, as you mentioned, the kind of, you know, the sort of relational nature of talent and the role of agents and how digital has kind of transformed that, particularly maybe to extend what you've just said into that idea of a culture versus commerce kind of distinction, you know, that it has increasingly, you know, sort of given way to the idea of getting hits, you know, bringing a ready-made audience, that kind of stuff. So what's been the sort of the impact of digital on talent?
Yeah, I mean, that was obviously one of the core elements of the book, really looking at how has the shift to a kind of multi-platform television environment changed, or indeed has it changed, the way in which the industry identifies, nurtures and develops talent. So it wasn't just about talent identification, but also about the way that it nurtures and develops, because again, that's kind of an important part of the equation. And the multi-platform environment has means that we've gone from a, you know, over the last 20 years from, you know, relative scarcity in potential television outlets and channels, and even debates about what we mean by television anymore. And it's not that long ago, 4 or 5 years, we were being told that television as we understood it was finished, but actually we see that has proven to be remarkably resilient. And looking at the ways in which, how has that impacted or affected the ways in which talent agents or the ways that particular types of talent find their way into the industry. And as you mentioned at the start, that became very, you know, very topical in one sense, because particularly in the UK, but not exclusively, the UK television sector, where the book is primarily focused, issues of diversity, issues of the range of representations, issues of the types of talent or people who are able to work and progress in the industry have all moved up both the industry and political agenda. So the kind of two of them, as it were, come together.
In terms of that transformation, I'm thinking we might do a case study here to sort of to sketch that out. But before we do, we probably need to know a little bit about the media kind of ecosystem for talent. So I wonder if you could maybe like sketch out, I mean, this is sort of tricky, isn't it? Because, you know, both the historical sections of the book and inevitably discussions about, you know, the sort of intricacies of the difference between, say, BBC and independent television could be quite extensive. But maybe give a kind of a brief snapshot of the media ecosystem for talent in the UK before we turn to a show that I really hate, I must admit, but the story of Top Gear, which has been, you know, incredibly successful and is such a great story for the, you know, the impact of digital and ideas about talent on screen as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose historically within the UK television industry, how I would particularly characterise talent was the BBC and ITV were the two main players, public service broadcasters. They would often sweep up people from other sectors of the what we would now call the cultural economy. Traditionally, from television, it was often taken from theatre and theatrical performances. People moved into television, etc. And very, very broad brush, I should say. What often happened is that when talents were identified or people were identified, they were often taken into quite a paternalistic environment where they were often developed and nurtured, given often time to develop, and space to develop. And this is true also of off-screen talent. So it's particularly true, for example, of producers. So you used to come into an organization like the BBC at a relatively low level. You would work your way up to a producer. And if you were fortunate enough and stayed long enough, you may end up becoming a channel controller, or you may move up into the editorial side of the organization. And in that process, you were kind of inculcated into the values institutional thinking of that organization. So it was very much relatively longer term. And once you were in that system, be on or off screen, it was often quite hard actually to get out of it again. So once you had got in to television, you often ended up moving around in the sector. Now, that has all changed, and the change in part comes about in the 90s and the 2000s with the advent of pay television and cutbacks and more competition and changing organisations. But the shift to the multi-platform environment has put a lot of pressure on organisations such as the BBC and ITV to be much more focused on their ratings, to be much more focused on their audiences. And the biggest change, I suppose, is that those nursery slopes where talent could be spotted and nurtured and developed have become much more difficult to move on from. A lot of people go onto the nursery slopes and they never actually move further on up the mountain, to use that analogy. And that's a change. And secondly, if you take something like ITV, a commercial PSB network, it has become so concerned and focused on the economic ratings advertising dimension to it that actually it kind of has abdicated in many ways trying to nurture and develop new talent in the way. So it's much more likely to want to buy talent off the shelf. It's wanting to buy established types of talent that will allow itself to immediately have a hit or immediately make an impact in the ratings. Whereas, again, 10, 15 years ago, often people came up through small programs. Children's television, for example, was a classic avenue for on-screen producers or on-screen presenters. And so it's become much more short-term. It's become much more uncertain. Career trajectories have become much more difficult to kind of choreograph or to kind of to manage in that sense. And then in that way, it very much replicates the broader concerns around people working in the industry, where actually you have fundamentally an increasingly freelance, short-term, contract-to-contract workforce, all trying to kind of make a name for themselves and in a relatively short space of time. So that, broadly speaking, that's been the biggest shift. The biggest shift has been from a relatively small pool, once you were in, having longevity and long careers and also been nurtured and developed and inculcated into the culture, to one in which, certainly on ITV, really their kind of prime concern on screen is to buy in talent that is already fully developed. And I suppose as a sports fan and a soccer fan yourself, Dave, you would recognise some of those analogies with elite football clubs, where the difference between nurturing and developing longer term homegrown talent in many ways disappears, and the economic drive of the sports sector and the television sector is to have instant hits, instant success, and it's seen the way to do that is to buy already established talent.
I guess what's interesting with that analogy is, you know, the key player here is something like Amazon, which effectively kind of bought not just on-screen talent, but, you know, an off-the-shelf program in the form of Top Gear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can make analogies, again, in soccer terms with, like, Manchester City or something like that. But obviously there are always, you know, institutions that would operate in this way. And what's really interesting is, I guess, the kind of the sense of Top Gear giving us an example of how this can work to create really big winners, but with little or nothing going back into the system, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good example of, I suppose, if you were saying there was a kind of a movement, and if you take the BBC in the British context as a key historical and still a key player in the television ecosystem, the BBC historically was renowned for not paying the top dollar for talent. But what the BBC offered you was a creative environment, an environment where the money would be on the screen as opposed to necessarily being paid out in big individual star salaries. And often people then, at the end of their careers, migrated to ITV, where they got a big pay packet, but often were in kind of decline creatively and artistically. And what's happened over the years, and happened for the BBC about 10, 15 years ago, is that the market's changed and the BBC started to try to attract and pay top salaries. So it began to compete at that top level. And the issue of the example of Top Gear, I suppose, is a good example of where what happens is the BBC nurtures and develops a particular type of talent, in this case, a presenter such as Jeremy Clarkson, establishes that brand and that value. And then, of course, in his case, after disciplinary issues, he then goes off and, as it were, really monetizes big time. that brand that was established on the BBC platform for a rival. And it kind of echoes a tradition of the last 15 or 20 years, which has seen a rise of kind of talent-driven producers or talent-driven production companies, where production companies suddenly decide, or talent, top talent suddenly decides, why am I not getting the money for producing this program? I'll tell you what, I'll set up my own production company, and then we'll actually get the money for that as well as paying for me, etc. And that rise of, I suppose, producer-led production companies and talent-led production companies started, I think, ironically enough, by Rowan Atkinson with the Tiger Aspect back in the late 1980s, became a kind of a model for how top talent. So Jeremy Clarkson on Top Gear at his time at the BBC recognised that there was a problem with a public service broadcaster paying what were seen to be exorbitant salaries to top presenters, and it became a political issue. And what he did was he actually used his production company in various complex financial relationships with the BBC and rights and IP, which meant that he could say hand on heart the BBC's salary was not among the top earners, but of course he was making considerable financial gain through the relationship he had with his financial production, with his production company and the relationship with the BBC. So behind the kind of the front of the shop Top Gear program, behind the scenes, you actually have a kind of a microcosm of what is going on within the industry as elite talent tries to take more control, tries to increase their financial value, and then, of course, ironically, goes off and really has the big payday on the back of the career built at the BBC, but providing no advantage, in one sense, to the organisation like the BBC that created it, when, as you mentioned, Amazon and others who have entered into the market, they don't want to nurture talent. They haven't got the time to nurture talent. Their business model is different. They're not a public service broadcaster. They've got no concerns particularly around diversity or representation. They're about making money. And they're going to do that in as quick a manner as they see possible. And to do that, you need to have, you need to make noise. You need to have profile. You need to get known about. And the easiest way to do that is to buy top-tier talent, top-tier controversial talent, even better.
I mean, it's really interesting because that is a useful illustration of the strengths of the book, that, you know, you can't just talk about the idea of, you know, Amazon has bought Top Gear, or, you know, they've poached talent or whatever. To understand the stuff, you need to know the transformation of the structures underneath this. And the other sort of parallel aspect of this is the rise of new platforms and mechanisms for talent development that are in some ways, you know, kind of replacing that old system of institutions, but in other ways actually are very, very different and have a very different logic, and in some ways are kind of much riskier. And I guess the example is YouTube and how that works in terms of kind of feeding talent into the system.
I mean, one of the jumping off points for the project in the book was also reading some of the, particularly the kind of UK business trade press, where there was clearly a concern among some people in the television industry that the next generation of talent was not coming into television, but was actually, as you say, going into the social video environment, was going into the YouTube environment, and that there was a danger that if television didn't in some shape or form begin to address this, that they were going to lose out on a whole new generation of talent. Now, underpinning that was also a broader concern, which was that fundamentally people under the age of 16 or between 16 and 24 were spending far more time online watching YouTube and other online channels than they were watching traditional linear television. Now, in one sense, that's always been the case. It's why sport is such a cachet, because 16 to 24-year-old males tend not to watch a lot of television, but they will watch sport on television. But so that concern was something that was was interesting and I wanted to explore in the book. And what I think, what emerged for me was that you have almost two distinct ecologies. You have the ecologies, the ecology of television and the television sector, and that includes free-to-air, pay television, and also channels that are delivered OTT, over-the-top, through video, etc. You also then have the ecology of the YouTube, to use a shorthand, the most successful platform, the YouTube platform, where people create channels, they create networks of channels, and they monetize that, and at the very top end of it, they make an awful lot of money, and they are inevitably young talent, young people, and they are inevitably speaking to a younger demographic and audience. And that's why suddenly advertisers have piled into the online environment, often at the detriment of the traditional television sector. And television naively, I think, thought originally that if you bring across talent that exists in the social video environment, you bring it into television, then that audience will come with you, and with that audience will come advertisers and eyeballs, etc. And that simply didn't work. And ITV had a very unsuccessful period trying to use some of its new digital platforms to actually try to experiment with new talent. But all they simply did was buy in people from that had a profile on YouTube and whatever, took them into a television environment, which is completely different, and it didn't work, or in some cases was controversial to the extent that caused more reputational damage. So I think what emerges is two distinct ecologies with some overlap in the middle. There is some overlap, unquestionably, and I look at that in the book, and I look at that particularly around BBC Three, and also around in BBC Scotland have got a very interesting project called The Social, where they actually are using public service money, public service expertise to actually engage and talk with people working in the social video environment, not trying to turn them into television presenters, not trying to say we want you to now work in our business, but to recognise that actually there is increasingly a kind of an online space that somehow exists between the traditional YouTube platform and the traditional television platform. So they're trying to reach out into that and extend the BBC brand to make it relevant to that generation of people, some of whom I have no doubt will go on and have big careers in television, many of whom won't have careers in television because, frankly, they're not interested in that or they don't want to do that. But I think that's been a big changer, partly driven by fear from television, but also driven by this shift where advertisers and the money, to put it crudely, has gone online, because that is where they can reach and monetize and commercialize products, services endorsed by, promoted often by these younger YouTubers who are almost in many cases self-starting entrepreneurs to some extent, some of whom have aspirations to work in television. As I say in the book, ironically, television can't afford some of the top online YouTube talent because actually they make more money online than they would from television. So again, if your driver is financial, why would I want to work in television? So it's become a much more complex environment than it was even 5, 6, 7 years ago.
I mean, we could conclude with maybe like a moral question, because obviously what we discussed is you've alluded to kind of equality and diversity issues, but we've discussed mm-hmm. the kind of the structures of cultural production, which, you know, are kind of objectively important, even beyond, you know, kind of questions about who is on screen and how they're represented. But I guess one of the things the book does at the end, and I think this speaks directly to where the public debate is this kind of question about how will this impact on what's on screen and off screen? Because to an extent, this new kind of set of ecologies promises quite a lot in terms of different forms of representation, in terms of, you know, specific cultural and social groups having, you know, choice and being represented much more directly in a more complex environment that isn't bureaucratically controlled and dominated by other social groups. But at the same time, as you've kind of gestured to, the need to make money, the focus on commerce, the unwillingness to kind of take time nurturing talent and to think about the patterns of, you know, demographics that are coming into the industry beyond does it sell, does it generate advertising, also means that, you know, the kind of moral questions of equality and diversity aren't there. So I guess the kind of the question from that is sort of, are you hopeful that, you know, we might see this kind of new ecology changing representation and diversity on television? Or is it a case of, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting issue. And I think for me, in a funny way, brought me right back to where I started in the book, which was not to set out some sort of, you know, defense of publicly funded television, far from it. And I've often been a critic of the kind of rather paternalistic, rather often complacent, and actually often class-based nature of an organization such as the BBC. And I think I picked that up in the historical chapter where, when it was nurturing talent, it was often the talent of the of a very small social elite who either had the financial or cultural capital to kind of enter into there. And so it was far from democratic, far from democratic. And that, I think, is one of the kind of appeals to some extent of the social video environment, is that it appears democratic, or at least gives the illusion of democracy in it. In terms of building careers, however, in terms of, you know, providing something that is sustainable, it's actually far from democratic. And other writers have looked at this in different sectors. And ultimately, it is financially, completely financially underpinned by advertising. And it kind of brings us back to, as I say, where I started, which was that out with the BBC, advertising was the kind of the lubricant that kept British television, has sustained British television over the years. And actually, it is the same underpinning financial underwriter, if you like, of the new social video environment. And the concern is that that means that it dictates the types of content, the types of embedding of brands and commercial aspects into kind of everyday kind of cultural activity in a way which, you know, frankly, some commercial, even public service commercial television would balk at, because actually it's still a relatively regulated environment. You can do things on YouTube, on the YouTube platform. You can say things which you would never get away with on British television, because it's simply, you know, there isn't the evidence to support it. And I'm talking here about commercial products and things, you know, claims you might make about X, Y, and Z. So it is largely unregulated and driven by that. On the upside, having said that, on the upside, there is no doubt there is a generation of people often who have experience of the broader creative sector coming in through YouTube and other online platforms. And the fact that the BBC and Channel 4 in particular have attempted to reach out into that does give me some confidence, or some hope, that actually in that process they will bring through differing forms of talent. And often it's off screen, particularly around writers and giving people the opportunity to perhaps work on things like the social, to perhaps then progress on to BBC Three, to develop their kind of writing skills or whatever that might be. So I think it does offer those opportunities to bring that in a more diverse way. But I think the social video environment itself is a highly commercially driven environment, you know, driven by the games industry, a big player in it, and advertising, and that's fine, but that it is what it is, and it's not offering a range of representations in the way that still publicly funded television is tasked with doing, be that particularly the BBC or Channel 4. And they do it in an imperfect way, and they get a lot wrong. But actually, if you were to pull away tomorrow the license fee, or pull away a level of guaranteed funding, then, you know, and associate regulation, then, you know, there would be no reason for any of this kind of talent development or nurturing to go on in the way that the BBC and Channel 4 particularly are committed to. And I think that would be to the long-term detriment of the industry. But it's very much an ongoing situation in the sense that there has never been a perfect time or perfect pathways into television. That was one of the things I wanted to make a point of in the book, because often people seem to herald back to a golden age. And actually, I want to suggest there never really was a golden age. And actually, how you got into television was often driven by your family background, by your class position, by your, you know, if you lived in London or if you lived in a big city, et cetera, et cetera. And it was never perfect, and often by networks of elites. And actually, the idea that we can create a system now which will be perfect is, again, I think, a misnomer. I think we can do much more. But actually, it's always been, a bit like the creative sector itself, it's always been inherently uncertain. And so the idea that you can pull a few policy levers and create these pathways which will unproblematically extend diversity and do all the things that the politicians and others would like the television sector to do, I think is a bit of a misnomer as well. And I think there's always going to be this fluidity, uncertainty, a mixture almost of structure and agency going on. Being in the right place at the right time still actually matters. Often in terms of being identified as a new talent.
In terms of your own work, and if I may, your own talent, what are you going to be using that for next? Are you going to kind of concentrate more on that sport and creative sector comparison, mm-hmm. or, you know, I mean, there's lots in the book that suggest itself for further research. You know, we could have discussed, like, you know, more sort of theoretical elements, ideas about cultural intermediaries that, you know, you pursue, or, you know, are you sort of bored of writing about television and it's time to write about something else?
Well, obviously, I mean, this is showing my age here, but this is the eighth book that I've been either single-authored or multi-authored or co-authored. And after each one, particularly one that's maybe single or co-authored, I always say, I'm not doing that again, because it doesn't particularly get any easier. So I'll sort of wait and see. I mean, the area that I'm particularly interested in next, trying to explore, is actually going back into the sports industry. And I'm interested very much in these debates about ownership and about whether ownership of, for example, you mentioned earlier, soccer clubs, as we might say in the North American context, to what extent ownership of soccer clubs actually matters in terms of performance or matters in terms of the culture and the cultural positioning and the social positioning of that club within communities and identities. So something around that relationship between, does ownership matter? Does it matter, for example, that your local football club is owned by some North American or Asian franchise who maybe only turn up once in a while? Does that really matter as long as they're putting in loads of money? Does it impact on the club's performance? Does it impact on the culture and identity of the club? And I suppose, you know, does it matter? Does it make a difference? And I'm kind of interested in kind of exploring that a bit more. And I think that's going to be kind of one of the areas I want to kind of develop, of which, of course, the media and television and television rights and monies, etc., are part of the story, part of the backstory to that. And indeed, often in many cases, part of the front story, because often, you know, it's for, you know, Manchester City was not bought to make money. Manchester City was bought for a whole host of other reasons, which are around promotion and around getting into differing media and other types of markets. So the television media side of it will still very much be there, but coming at it and re-engaging again, I think, with the sports industry sector would be something that I would like to be doing.